Hey there, and welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I talk about embodiment. We discuss what embodiment means, how trauma gets stored in the body, the consequences of disembodiment, how chronic stress and emotional repression affect the body, strategies for getting in tune with your body, embodied psychedelic experiences, and much, much more. A couple of announcements for you before we get into today's episode. If you're looking for professional training pursuant to becoming a psychedelic assisted practitioner, check out the courses we offer here at Numinous. You can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/training, and you can use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. If you've listened to the show for a while, you occasionally hear Reed and I talk about the psychedelic clinical trial work we do here at Numinous. If you or someone you know might be interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn about the trials we're currently running. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by leaving us a review or a rating in places like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you're watching on YouTube, like the video, you can comment below. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with somebody you think might also enjoy it. Without further ado, here is our episode today on embodiment. So Reed, we are recording this episode on a kind of a fun day. Today is April 19th, otherwise known as Bicycle Day.
Which happens to be 420 Eve.
Yeah. And happens to be my deceased father's 95th birthday.
Oh, wow.
If he were alive today, he'd be 95. That's my dad, by the way, not my yeah. grandfather.
I can't remember how old Albert Hoffman was when he died, but he was in his 90s.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How old was he when he synthesized LSD?
37.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he was in his 30s, but... What's interesting is he synthesized LSD 5 years before the Bicycle Day, that April 19th, 1943 event that now gets commemorated.
Right.
And interestingly, 3 days before Bicycle Day is the day he actually dipped his finger in. Bicycle Day, he took it on purpose. Mm-hmm. Like in his lab notebook, he measured out, what was it, 250 micrograms, which was 0.00005 teaspoons of LSD. And he actually thought he was going to die. He thought he was, after he rode home on his bike with his lab assistant, at first it was like gingerbread, kaleidoscope visuals. Oh, cool. Mm. But then it turned a little dark and the scary, like masked face warped and witchy of his neighbor was like flying in and out of the room, and he was a bit terrified. But because he was kind of floating in and out of his body, he had a lot of thoughts of, oh no, is this the end? Am I dying? Have I already died? Mm. Oh no, my family and my work isn't done. Mm-hmm, But then, that passed, as it does. And he even had arranged this house call for a doctor to check on his delirium.
Oh, wow.
Who gave him a thumbs up on his clean bill of health.
Clean bill of health.
Yeah. He was, I think, 37 on Bicycle Day. Mm, mm-hmm. But do you want to hear an Albert Hoffman quote from the 90s?
Sure.
He, such a wise and interesting fella and contributed so much. He had a lot to do with figuring out how to synthesize psilocybin, in fact. And he took a lot of LSD quite often, even into his 90s. Mm. But he said this at a speech at the Worlds of Consciousness in Germany, reflecting on his LSD experiences. He said, "Only when we are conversant with both heaven and hell is our life full and rich. And it is fuller and richer the more deeply we experience both. The psychedelic experience can lead us to the deepest depths and the highest heights, to the boundaries of that which humankind is capable of experiencing."
Wow. It kind of reminds me of that quote, I think, that comes from the Eleusinian Mysteries. Maybe Cicero said that, like, through the mysteries, we learn to die. Like, we die first so that we can learn to live with better hope.
Yeah.
It fascinates me, and it's, you know, one of the many things that can be useful about a psychedelic experience is helping a person die, like grapple with that existential fear. We die first so that we can live better.
Yeah. Yeah. It is fascinating because no one usually wants to go through an experience of hell.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But there is so much written about what can be gained. And, you know, those who have had that experience can attest to it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel that way about the dark nights I've been through.
Right.
Like, I'd never wish them on myself or others, but you certainly do come out stronger and return with gifts, if you will, and an expanded perspective. So many things that you can then be grateful for.
Right. You know, this is what we plan to talk about, but your comment made me think of my wife saw this clip on TikTok of all places, but from this, I think, psychologist who encountered a meta-analysis of a bunch of trauma studies,
mm-hmm.
Looking at this concept of post-traumatic growth and whether or not it's an actual thing. And like, do most people who encounter experience or a series of experiences that we would call traumatic end up growing because of them? And apparently this meta-analysis says no. Like, if people experience trauma, it's often a net negative. But it also doesn't rule out the possibility or the reality, I guess I should say, of post-traumatic growth. And I don't have the study in front of me. It's just popping into my memory. But
well, it's really an interesting question, and it depends how you define trauma, because every day we are experiencing some kind of stress,
challenge,
right?
Or stress.
There's trauma, stress, and other wounds. And PTSD is its own thing, mm-hmm. right? And that doesn't happen from every trauma, even capital T trauma. It depends on, you know, like we've talked about on here, your ability to hold and process that at the time, the resources you have and the support you have. And so not all trauma turns to PTSD. And PTSD, I think is something I would never wish on someone.
Right, it's a disorder, right?
Yeah.
That's the D.
But trauma, stress, and other wounds are part of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it does tie into what we'll be talking about today, which is embodiment, which is probably the greatest resource for healing from those things.
Right.
Yeah.
So perhaps a segue, I didn't warn you about this, but it's a question that I have. We have books like Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score. We have, you know, polyvagal theory from Stephen Porges. We have mm-hmm. Peter Levine's work, somatic experiencing. And you'll hear often that that trauma is stored in the body. So when somebody says trauma is stored in the body, what do they mean? Like, we can think of memories being stored in a variety of ways in the mind, in the brain, actually, right? And there are certain regions of the brain and structures in the brain that are implicated in memory. But what are we talking about when we say that the trauma is stored in the body?
Yeah. Interestingly, I got that question last night on a panel.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was sitting on a panel with some of our dear friends from the Black Physicians of Utah group, mm-hmm. and it was on psychedelics and mental health, and someone asked this question: does the body really keep the score? What do you think? And so it was fun to hear the various answers, because I've had that question as well. I love the title of Bessel's book, right?
Yeah.
Catchy, clever,
instructive,
repeatable. But you hear that a lot in yoga classes. You're doing a hip opener, and you know, people will talk about emotion stored in the body. And I like to think of it in this kind of broader sense of, well, two things. This broader sense of our bodies are the sum total of everything we've ever done and experienced, and our patterns, including our patterns of movement, how we stand, how we sit, which foot goes in front of the other first, and you know, which hand we use to brush our teeth, and all that stuff. It does get stored, right? And I think the question is maybe more asking of, do emotions get trapped in the body?
Mm.
Like, do traumas get literally trapped in the body? And, you know, I think that's also a yes. Like, even if I'm taking my most skeptical, scientific, grounded only in the literature type of approach to this question, experience something and you tense up, like you get punched in the gut, you tense up in response. And you might even hold that tension in your gut as a protective mechanism. And therefore, you're walking around life with a tensed up gut more and more. You get punched enough, you're probably going to keep it that way a lot.
Well, and that sort of brings to mind simple Pavlovian conditioning or learning theories of the way beings with brains learn. So like if I make a sound and then I blow in your face, then, you know, you're going to blink and maybe wince and maybe you're anticipating bad breath or whatever. And so if that happens multiple times, every time you hear a sound, your nervous system is going to react, right? And it might be pre or sub conscious, meaning that you don't go through a conscious process before you brace in response to this now conditioned stimulus, this sound, right? So maybe one way that trauma gets stored in the body is it's stored in a central nervous system pattern, right?
Yeah.
We aren't just like super wet supercomputers housed in a meat robot. Like the separation between the body and the mind is a dubious separation. So you'll hear people sometimes now refer to as the body mind, right? That it's not separate. Yeah. And so maybe one way that trauma is so-called stored in the body, it's not that a memory is stored in your bicep in the same way that a memory is stored in, you know, the hippocampus or something like that. But there's a pattern that's stored in this very complicated network of nerves and organs and chemical pathways that make up the human nervous system.
Yeah, and that's speaking to what the rebus theory speaks to as well, relaxed beliefs under psychedelics, or what falls under this broader concept of the entropic brain and the free energy principle, which has a kind of the background is that we are all prediction machines. As we go through life, we're wired to detect threat and behave accordingly. And we're wired to achieve reward, survive, and behave accordingly. And a lot of that wiring is about how the body responds and moves, right? And so this is managed by the taking in the sensory inputs from the bottom up, and it's checked against these top-down hierarchies that are layered on as predictions. And if there's a mismatch, like you know, someone's blowing in your face all of a sudden, there's new sensory input in, and then your mirror neurons and other things will take note of the face that the person who kept blowing in your face, and will probably, without you even have to think about it, start to respond to that. As long as you have this balance of taking in the sensory bottom up inputs and taking them into account in the hierarchy, it being relatively malleable. And the idea with rebus is that psychedelic can make it more malleable, or really bring the weight back to the sensory inputs that many people get disconnected from as they move through life.
Right. So the stuckness then, is it in the rebus model, they talk about priors, like these experiences become priors. They become a priori
predictions.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you can imagine a person maybe who was met with a lot of trauma, interpersonal trauma as a child, as their nervous system is developing. And so they experience harm or abandonment in response to their efforts to receive connection, like crying as a baby or asking for support. They develop a belief, a prediction, right? And then that prediction gets generalized as they age. So now no one is a source of safety, or the people from which I would like to get love, I'm so used to getting rejection and hurt that I start to seek out relationships where that's present in this weird paradoxical way, because that's what I'm used to. That's what my priors dictate.
Yeah, you can... it's not always possible, but you can, in theory, trace back all of these current beliefs to an origin, or, you know, you start to see how, oh yeah, it makes sense that this person is not going to trust others by default, where this other person might. And it's because, they grew up in a world where trust wasn't possible, or, you know, it wasn't wise to trust. So I'm glad you're bringing up that example, because it's not just the blowing in your face. Like, that might feel like there's a bit of a leap to the kind of emotional worlds we have, but it certainly does apply in a similar way to things like our ability to trust and, you know, our kind of tightly held core beliefs around our worth, around self and others.
Right. Yeah. So if we draw our attention back to the body and embodiment and how the body keeps the score, many of you listening might have had this experience, or you know people who've had this experience, or if you're helping professionals, you've worked with people who've had an experience where, you know, they're experiencing some discomfort in their body, some chronic pain, chronic stomach issues, or autoimmune condition, and they don't really understand it, right? They've gone to lots of doctors, they may have had a lot of medication, maybe they've had some body work done, and it just seems to be getting worse, and they're not making a connection between what's happening in their body and their mood state or a traumatic past. So another way that maybe the body keeps the score, or that trauma lives in the body, is it's producing, you know, we could get biophysiological about this. It's producing sort of a chronic state of stress hormone imbalance where, you know, cortisol is present when it's not useful to be present. Yeah. It creates chronic stress, and that affects other organ systems. It affects the immune system. It affects the inflammation system. So you end up with, you know, a stomach ache, a chronic stomach ache. And so you might interpret that as my stomach is keeping the score of my trauma, right? My stomach is where I carry my stress. Or it could simply be muscle tension. We've had reports from, you know, massage therapists or people who've gone to body workers where, you know, this is a fairly unconscious process, but the body worker finds a spot, let's say the shoulder, the trap, like, wow, you carry a lot of tension here. And they're working on that spot, and a memory comes, right? They didn't summon this memory, but it's the direct stimulation of this area of the body. And all of a sudden memory comes up, and perhaps it's a traumatic memory.
Yeah. And, you know, while I believe there are explanations, again, in theory, for a lot of these processes, these psychosomatic things, we often don't have the ability to pinpoint it, or the body and the mind are such complicated, intricate machinery,
right,
that we simply don't understand it all, or can't keep tabs on it all. Whether the explanations in, you know, physics or quantum physics or whatever are yet to be discovered. But a couple things come to mind as you're giving those examples. I remember my first ayahuasca experience when out in the jungle where I'm, the first night I drink the medicine. The first thing that happens as it kicks in, other people start throwing up. There's this symphony of vomit, and the Shipibo shaman is dishing out these like epic chants that are just like jackhammering our emotional bodies and cracking them open. But for me, the response was just tears. I just cried, and I couldn't even tell where they were coming from. Like, there wasn't a story attached to these. But then later on, a couple other things. One of the shamans or medicine team members, a woman who was more of a Lakota lineage, she was going around drumming and singing these beautiful lullabies. And I was shocked because she was drumming at approximately like 50 beats a minute. And my heart dropped down to that and stuck on the rhythm of the drum.
No kidding.
And I don't have an explanation for that. I don't. And then she comes around and says, "Reed, may I work on you?" And sure. What do you say to that, right?
No, thanks.
And I don't even know what she's going to do, but she just, I'm laying there on my mat and she's just waving her hands around my body, like hovering. She's not touching at all. Mm. And then she got curious about something around my lungs and chest area. But then as she moves down over my belly, I get this, and this rarely happens to me, I get this abdominal cramp. You ever had your ab muscles cramp up?
Oh, yeah.
And then she's kind of energy working over my legs and gets down to one of my legs. I don't remember which one, but it cramped up.
Wow.
Like, yeah. So it's just an interesting embodiment story that I don't have the answers to, but point is like you said, the mind and the body are so mutually connected, inseparable in many ways, and mutually influential.
Yeah. It might be, you know, it might be more true to say, to like stop even distinguishing between the mind and the body as if they are different things. Like, the mind is our entire body and our body is our entire mind.
Yeah.
Not that I have this thought fully fleshed out, but it just, it makes sense as we talk about embodiment and what it means to be a whole person, that these things, that we are greater than the sum of our parts, and that maybe our mind is not simply, like I said, the software running on this hardware. Like, it's all part of the same whole.
Yeah. I do find it useful to be able to lump these, and maybe this is a trap that I'm just in, but to lump the mind and the body into these categories, like the thinking mind, the monkey mind, the overthinking potential, and the body as my gateway to the here and now to get out of that. Mm. That's been a useful, quick hack tool framework to get back into the here and now. But I also agree with you completely. In fact, I've been in the mindfulness world for quite some time, but for like a decade or more, I've said to myself and out loud sometimes that mindfulness just does not capture it as a term. Like, and I realize that bodyfulness is kind of a weird term in and of itself, but yeah, the body is so crucial to these things.
Well, maybe embodiment is the better term. I don't know. Like
embodied mindfulness.
Embodied mindfulness. So when people talk about embodiment, mindfulness is often discussed as well. So
yeah,
you talk about mindfulness and embodied mindfulness being a gateway to the present moment. That's something that I'll be transparent. I have lived in my mind, if we're going to keep separating the two, for most of my life. Relied on my mind and my intellect to figure things out. And the connection that I have with my body is, I don't know, you know, I certainly move through space with my body. I train my body as an athlete and, you know, relate to my body when it's sending me signals that I'm not taking good enough care with it. But I've noticed that if I don't pay attention to it, I'm missing out on a lot of really important data, a lot of really important information.
Yeah.
So as I've been meditating lately, especially working with psychedelics and getting more, training around using embodiment strategies and principles to help our clients. Instead of like watching my thoughts, I'm just feeling my body, like feeling what's present. And I sometimes get bored quickly. Like I'm not used to really paying attention to my body in that way, but every once in a while to be like, oh, this feels different. This is different than watching my thoughts. Like following my sensations feels different.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I was thinking about this today, in fact, just the terms out-of-body experience that people kind of both revere and, of course, don't want because it's often equated with a near-death experience. But I think, well, one, we want people to have an in-body experience, right? There's your body is how you experience the world. It's your greatest resource in many ways too. It's how we move about the world. And so that idea of like a burning in your bosom or the body, even some forms of Buddhism, like Vajrayana Buddhism or whatever, will view like the body as the gateway to eternity, you know, and rather than what you might be tempted to think of like exiting the body and going to those places. I really believe that even the mystical experience, because that's how we experience our emotions, like how we give and receive love in the real world. I believe it's it happens through this instrument that is our bodies.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So if people are maybe disconnected from their emotions, or they have a tendency to suppress emotion or deny emotion, we could maybe say that they're also disconnected from their bodies. They're disembodied.
Yeah. And I think personally, and I'm an embodiment junkie, let's just say, and that's why I also find it fascinating of like what you said about boredom in following that versus the mind. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting distinction because the body is always in the here and now. Mm-hmm. Of course, we can trip out on, you know, past stories attached to things from there and wander in the mind. But yeah, if you're not embodied, I think it's the worst thing that can happen to humanity. Mm. I'll just say that because if you are not in your body and you are not in your feelings, your empathy, your compassion, where you feel your emotions, like where you have the ability to really feel another's suffering. And so if we're disembodied, as we move through the world, we're more likely to trample on it and not care and not be connected with Mother Earth and its aliveness and its majestic beauty, where you might not be crampling, like squishing your water bottle and chucking it into the beautiful forest if you're more embodied and connected to that. Same goes, and this becomes even more tragic, but if you're disembodied and you're not in tune with the suffering of another human, you're much more likely to harm them, to go to war with them, to not view them as part of yourself, your humankind family.
Yeah. Okay. So just, I'm going to be obnoxious here for a minute and just ask some questions about some of the language that we're using.
Yeah.
So to be in your body, right? You talked about the dangers of being out of your body and how important and crucial it is to be embodied. What does that actually mean? Like, what does it mean to be in one's body or attuned to it or connected to it?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question because it's not just body scanning, right? Embodiment isn't just like saying, oh yeah, I feel that thing in my left foot. It's tingling or numb or whatever. Embodiment is your sense of wholeness, your home, being in your home, like is your experience of the world, right? It's inhabiting the body isn't just awareness of it. It's actually living in it with that awareness, not just in the body, but as it, you know, and it is a bit ineffable, but it's our experience of perception, how we move about the world, how we, it's the vehicle for our thoughts and our feelings. And because it's always in the present, it's also one of the greatest resources for returning to the here and now.
I like that. So some things I've noticed about my body when I'm paying attention, right? A sensation in my chest that's kind of like that sensation where you're like, you go over the first hill in a roller coaster, kind of this little jumping sensation. It's not a burning or maybe it's like an electricity, but there's something, right? Kind of in my sternum that drops in down into my gut. And, you know, if I'm not paying attention, sometimes I'm missing when this sensation comes up and I'm not really learning what it's trying to tell me. So as I've tried to pay attention, this is just an example, right? As I've tried to pay attention to this particular sensation, I've noticed other times that it shows up. So I've noticed, you know, when I am about to give a public speech or something like that, or when somebody criticizes me, or, you know, it's often related, I guess, to anxiety or the anticipation of some kind of social threat, usually. And then it often will then cascade into trembling in my body, like shaking. It makes me think of, you know, why zebras don't get ulcers by Sikorsky, the kind of discharge of energy.
They don't give speeches.
That's right. That's right. They don't have podcasts. Although if any of you know of a zebra podcast, I'm into it. So yeah, in the past, when I haven't really been paying attention, I would just find myself miserable and not realize like, oh, there were warning signs that are telling me like, this is the kind of thing that your mind is dealing with right now. And you can intervene at the level of the physiology, right? You can do a top-down intervention where you talk to yourself and talk back to your negative thoughts or whatever, or you could, like you were saying before, do a bottom-up intervention. You've called the breath, for example, the remote control of the nervous system before. So I've learned like when my body starts to tremble or when I feel this feeling in my chest that I can address it. I'd now have a better sense of what it's telling me and I can address it directly through breath or something like that. So perhaps that's an example of trying to live embodied, like in your body.
Yeah. I think it's a really good example. And it's the one thing after playing with this stuff for many years now, one of the reasons why, besides saving the planet and humankind, right? But one of the reasons why I really, really not only like, but find it crucial to engage the body in work on healing and growth in the therapy room, in psychedelic work, is because it is our greatest resource, and it's a much more manageable path than just trying to do it with brute force of mental thinking and effort and determination. Like, good luck trying to beat the labyrinths of the mind with your mind only, right? Mm. Like, it's no small feat, but with, like, when you engage the body, you engage the emotional and psychological activities within yourself, past and present. But when you engage the mind, you're also, it's hard to just tease out, because you're also engaging the body. Like, a thought does have a physiologic response. That's why there's this inseparable disclaimer that that you brought up at the beginning. But when there's a mismatch, like, your posture or it doesn't reflect what is in your mind. In fact, let's try it. We've done this before a time or two, but let's just try it so everyone can try it with us. And if you're watching, don't make fun. We're hunching over, and in this hunched over stance, like the most defeated stance you can embody, repeat these words, Steve. I'm empowered to accomplish what I want in my life.
I'm empowered to accomplish what I want in life.
Good job. And now let's try the most powerful seated embodied stance, puffing your chest, broadening your shoulders, take a deep breath, feeling strong. And now say that same thing. Yeah.
I forgot what it was.
I'm empowered.
I'm empowered to accomplish what I want in my life.
Yeah. So if it doesn't feel right, like kind of like we're talking about with the priors and the prediction errors, is when there's a dissonance or lack of congruence, and we don't always listen to that, but that's telling, right? Mm-hmm. Part of the, you could view your body as the dashboard on your vehicle with all sorts of information. And why don't we pay attention? Like, like when the oil light is on, why don't we pull over?
Yeah, this, your example here reminds me of something we've talked about on the show before, when we talked about like how to navigate psychedelic experiences and some of the things that you can use to navigate those experiences, one of which is posture.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's tough. One of the great things about some psychedelic experiences is that they sort of take that monkey mind offline, and then you are confronted with your body and the signals that it's trying to send you. But if you find yourself stuck, for example, in a psychedelic experience, and you're trying to be curious and you're trying to lean in, but nothing seems to be helping you in and through, that sometimes adopting a different physical posture will give you that bottom up signal to move things through.
Yeah. It's a really good point. 'Cause in that ayahuasca story, if I were in a different posture when she had come around, like say I'm curled up in the fetal position on my side, constricting off to all of life and experience and whatever, her question would not have been, Reed, can I work on you? Mm. It would be like, okay, let's address first things first. What's going on here? Mm-hmm. Like, why are you shutting everything down? But even before that ceremony, there was advice on here are your two or three posture options. Like, lay down on your back on your mat with like even palms open to the sky in a receptive stance to receive and show openness. Or you might even sit up in a meditative posture of receiving. But it is not a recommended posture to curl up in a ball and hide.
Right. It makes me think of a client I had once on one of our psychedelic clinical trials, so participant, I guess, in this trial. And this person had a very low opinion of themselves and wanted a higher opinion of themselves, but couldn't solve that problem at the level of the mind.
Yeah.
Even if we would provide them all the evidence in the world that they were competent, that they actually achieved some things, that there were people who were impressed by them, it couldn't break through this particularly self-defeating belief.
Right?
So it's that unrelaxed belief, that cognitive fusion that is responsible for a lot of our psychological suffering. So instead, we had this participant imagine themselves as their ideal self, and imagine what that body posture would look like. How are they standing? Where are their hands? Where are their shoulders? And then they would just practice adopting that pose. Not because they believed it yet, but they wanted to step into what it felt like in their body. And then during the psychedelic experience, when the time was right, they did it. Right?
Yeah.
They just assumed the body posture. And under the influence of the psychedelic, it just sort of sunk in deeper. And they, because the monkey mind, the prior beliefs were a little bit more offline, they could connect with it in a more intimate way.
Yeah, cool.
And it was more believable.
Yeah, I like that. And the reason why I smile while hearing that, while it's, you know, it's not anything to get trivial about, is one's negative self-beliefs, but just because I can relate and I've seen it 1,000 times too. And I can relate too with how hard it is to just try and think your way out of that.
Right.
Right. Because if you want to have a choice, and I may be saying some controversial things today, my apologies,
how
but not sorry. and they're just my opinions, but if you want to change the patterns in your life, one of the greatest resources you have is your body. Mm. Like, because, you know, the awareness and the sensations that are coming in, from the world and from within inside of you, those give you the choice that only is present in the here and now, the choice to behave, show up, act, think, respond in a new way.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So psychotherapy is about changing the story from which we operate, right? Broadly speaking, debatable. And you can do this by accessing your, and trying to change your beliefs. And we also know that trying to think your beliefs differently takes a hell of a lot of time and effort. Or you can change the form and structure, or the shape that gives rise to that story, like the posture that gives rise to the feeling of power. Mm. And so if you want to do that, that's a faster path, in my opinion, to change. Yeah.
Faster path. Yeah. It makes me think of some of the clients I'm working with now who are severely traumatized and for whom a lot of their distress seems to be locked in and stored in their bodies. And
yeah.
These are really smart people. These are people that have been to lots of different psychotherapists and tried to approach their trauma at the level of the mind and haven't experienced a lot of, you know, relief, a lot of change, a lot of durable change. And so through some psychedelic sessions and through focusing more on this embodiment principle, they're starting to feel movement in
yeah.
these beliefs, but it wasn't because we started from the top down.
Yeah. No, I like that. Because so embodiment isn't just about tuning into your body. It's like being in your body and tuning into it and the world, right? So that's where we want to be. And that's where you can really tap into these things. Like, you can see what is resonating within you, what is alive in you, what is your real truth about how you should show up. And it takes present moment embodied mindfulness, in my opinion, to really tap into that. And so that's, I think, one of the ways or mechanisms by which that change happens.
Yeah. So other tips or tricks for how people might live more embodied, I guess another direction we could go is, are there some identifiable reasons why we have such a hard time being embodied in our modern day?
Yeah. So we were talking about trauma, stress, and other wounds, right? And so, and we were talking about how trauma is any event that you can't take in fully or process because it's too frightening and painful. And that system overwhelm often leads to a dissociative kind of state or experience, or a disconnect from some of the body systems in place, because like you drop a hammer on your toe and you're in fight or flight mode, and you're disconnected from it. It's just too painful for that time. And if the trauma is just too big or too repetitive, without the resources, we can get disembodied or disconnected in many ways. And that can be slow and sometimes painful, arduous process to re-inhabit, as we know from working with clients with trauma. And it can feel really scary at first, really scary. Mm-hmm. But then once you're able to have that corrective experience, that embodied experience, and really tap back into those resources, I think that's when you can start to like feel the resources there, like the sense of volume or weight that you have when you're grounded, right? Versus this shaky ground you might feel on when kind of floating through life because of having to disconnect.
Right. Yeah. I think that's one way of thinking of recovery from trauma is learning to feel safe and grounded in your body and in the present moment.
Yeah. And returning to that sense of personal power and aliveness and even stillness or peace that you can get in the body. Like maybe your boredom while like focusing on the body was just because it's a bit unfamiliar. And because as you truly enter the present moment, you do expand time. Mm-hmm. Like you do expand it, and you know, it becomes that slow motion kind of place where you can actually decide how you show up.
Yeah. As I've reflected on that experience of boredom, I think at least for me, it's a couple of things. It's one is like, if I were to go into a forest and be unfamiliar with what there is to see, I might feel pretty bored. But if I were to learn a lot about that forest, the different kinds of plants, the different kinds of animals, the different kinds of bugs, the different...
Yeah, that curiosity.
It provides a template upon which my curiosity can affix. But if I don't have that template, I'm just like, oh, trees. Then I get bored. And so it's similar with my body because I haven't spent a lot of time getting curious about the flora and fauna, like about what's going on with my body. Then there's not as much for me to be attracted to. That's one. Yeah. And I think... Also, my boredom might be a sort of a rejection of stillness. Like I don't want to be still.
Yeah, an antsiness, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I can relate. You know, it may be related, but the other day when I was in a rather difficult yoga class and thinking to myself, I do this pretty much every day. Mm. And why do I do it? Why do I like to do it? Why do I keep coming back? Because especially like when I can, you know, plan it right, I'll go to the same sequence and just go deeper and deeper on those same things. And there is something, I don't know, your flora and fauna example just made me think of that. If there's something there about like just peeling away the subtle layers and the infinite, you know, thing, the infinite ground to explore there.
Yeah, there's, if you pay attention, that I've heard Sam Harris say, regardless of what you might think of Sam Harris, I think his meditation app is great. And I've heard him say, once you really learn to pay attention to the present moment mindfully, you'll never be bored again. Mm-hmm. Because there's an infinite supply of things to examine, things to notice,
your
things
heartbeat to investigate. Or whatever.
Yeah. Or just the sensation, the experience of boredom itself can be something worthy of zooming out and looking at.
There's a meditation exercise I like to do and share with others. It's from Dan Siegel, who wrote a lot of great things on mindfulness, even The Mindful Therapist that I think is on my shelf. But the Wheel of Awareness goes through a bunch of different kind of levels of embodied awareness, including what's on top of your body, on the surface, like the feeling of like skin and a cool breeze or things like that, but also underneath, like, can you tune into the beating of your heart? I've worked with a lot of clients with this exercise in lots of different ways because this, like, you know, it has some relevance in the eating disorder work too of, you know, if you can tune in, if you can reclaim some interoception and some inward focus, like it's a good sign of like where you're headed in embodiment and tapping back into those resources, like your hunger and fullness cues, for example. Mm-hmm. But you can learn to tune into your heart rate. In fact, one thing I'll do when I'm bored in yoga class is check my pulse and look at my watch after to see if I am accurate. And the last time I did it this week, the first time I was like 1 point off, and the next time I nailed it, it's like 140 beats spot on. No, I can't do that all the time, but you can tune in more and more to different things the more you deeply you listen and practice it. Yeah. It
makes me think of other ways one can tune in. So, you know, I learned this, there's lots of different inquiry or inquiry techniques. for investigating the sensations of the body and their connections to traumas or to emotions or to memories or thoughts. And a lot of those come from the somatic experiencing world. But I learned one particular method from our friend Devin Christie called embodied inquiry.
Yeah.
And I know you're very familiar with embodied inquiry. So what are we talking about when we're talking about embodied inquiry?
Well, I think it's really, you know, just an extension of this topic in general is right. Using, like, I think it's even a misnomer to not, you know, at least say that some of these other methods of like Gabor Mate's compassion inquiry focuses a lot on the body. What are you feeling? Emotion-focused therapy, Hakomi, internal family systems, EMDR, embodied approaches. And I think embodied inquiry would just involve leveraging the body as that gateway
right.
to both insight and answers and history and potential.
Yeah. And not unlike navigating a psychedelic journey, there's some principles to guide such an inquiry process, like, you know, direct experience versus indirect experience. So what am I feeling right now?
Yeah.
You know, focus on that phenomenology. Like what are the textures? What are the sensations and elaborating them? Turning toward, leaning in instead of away.
If that part of the body could talk, what would it say? Like, that's maybe a common question a lot of these practices will use. Or if there's a truth needing to be expressed related to this emotion, how would you say it in your words?
Right.
Things like that.
Can I interrupt real quick? Because I used that one recently and it was really fruitful. So
cool.
A client who has a hard time, if I were just ask them, well, how are you feeling or what are you feeling? They'd be like, I don't know, bad.
Yeah.
But they started to cry. And I said, if those tears had a voice, what might they say? And there we go. We finally got into something.
I love that. Yeah. The IFS model has such great tools for doing those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Like, and they're really good about giving it to you practically speaking. Just a shout out to Dick Schwartz and all the trainers and all that. And interestingly, a lot of them come from, not all, but there's this relationship with the Hakomi world. And I had done some Hakomi training previously, and a lot of them have ended up also working in internal family systems or even transitioning over to training there. But I do love Hakomi's approach. And if anyone's not familiar, Hakomi, and there's a Hakomi Institute. It was founded by Ron Kurtz, a few decades ago or something, but what it does is it kind of creates a container for this healing relationship with a lot of gentleness and embodied mindfulness. So you establish that in some certain ways, and then you evoke experience, but not in a jarring way, like giving someone a 5-MeO DMT or something like that, or a massive cup of ayahuasca, but it's like, sometimes it would just be like waiting in stillness and something arises, or, or leaning into some of those sensations or asking those questions like you did of like, why the tears or sad, huh? And then that stuff comes up in the here and now, and you can work with it in the here and now with the body on board.
Right. Yeah. You know, you use that phrase leaning in, and that's a phrase we use a lot in psychotherapy and particularly in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. I thought it might be fun just to talk about, maybe even get some examples.
What
about
the hell does it mean?
What leaning in actually looks like. So just one that popped into my mind.
Yeah.
We're talking about paying attention to the body and the sensations in the body and using them, like we've discussed before with reference to triggers, as trailheads. So let's say you're in a meditation and you're trying to focus on the sensations in your body and you notice a sensation in your gut. What would it mean to lean in to that sensation in your gut? Well, first it might starts with awareness. Like, okay, I'm feeling something in my gut. Okay. Well, what are you feeling? Well, I don't know. It feels weird. Okay. Can you give it a texture? Right. And so there are these ways to elaborate on the sensation and then follow the chain reaction. So as I'm noticing this sensation in my gut, now I'm noticing a memory come up in my mind's eye, an image, or I'm noticing a thought, a particular thought, like this is dumb. Okay, all right. So when you have the thought that this is dumb, then what? So leaning in can be a kind of a fruitful exploration. It can be just following the thread, the trail, and see where it takes you.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up because it's an interesting one, and people might not intuitively be able to imagine what does lean in mean. And I've been kind of observing as I soak in different modalities and over the years, how some people talk about it. Like in internal family systems, I think a lot of people would say, can you stay with that?
Yeah.
And in compassion.
Sit with. Yeah. You hear that a lot. Sit with that feeling.
And in compassionate inquiry, I think, and I don't know if this comes from Gabor or if it's like the preference of some of the early key trainers, but they would say things like, blow it up, pump it up, make it big, like 10x that feeling.
Right.
And like what you mentioned of giving it a texture and a color and this kind of multi-sensory synesthesia exercise with your sensations is, you also see a lot of that in internal family systems.
Right.
And which I find quite useful too.
Yeah. It also implies a willingness to feel it.
Yeah.
Right? From the ACT world, acceptance and commitment therapy, there's this idea of part of acceptance is willingness. And willingness isn't a switch. It's not that you're unwilling or willing. It can be a dial. So like I'm turning up my dial of willingness to a one is what it was before with this sensation in my gut. And I'll turn it up to a five.
I like that.
So I'll just breathe and like pay attention to. So maybe lean in is pay attention to this feeling in my gut. And then maybe as I grow accustomed to it, I'm going to dial that dial up even more. And then I can blow it up or pump it up. Like you're saying.
I think it's important. And I think that's embodied wisdom is to listen to your body and honor what it says it's capable of right now,
right?
Because maybe blowing it up 10x would, you know, you might explode. Right.
Yeah. And that's just where we get that notion of the window of tolerance from somatic experiencing that.
Yeah.
And you establish a safe place, you identify what has been triggering, and you can, I believe the word is pendulate, right? You spend time in there as long as you're willing and have the capacity for it and the support. And then if it becomes too much, you can pendulate out back to a safe place.
Yeah, to like an oasis spot, as they might call it. Mm-hmm. 'Cause a lot of these approaches, like what's it called in Hakomi? I think it was what Ron Kurtz would call the missing experience. But this shows up in a lot of modalities of going, say there's a core belief in the here and now, going to that part of your childhood, that earliest memory you can identify of having felt that way and trying to really blow up, if you will, or re-experience, revisit in the most textured way what happened, and then bring in the nourishment, bring in the resources from the here and now, the reparenting of your inner child, if you will, the corrective experience internally to heal the unhealed part and rewrite the new story without that negative self-defeating core belief.
Yeah. And I want to say that this takes repetition. You know, we were talking earlier about the difference between living from the mind and the body. When we try to acquire a skill, it takes repetition, right? I could read a book on how to play the violin and I wouldn't be able to play it any better than I did before. But if I rehearse a scale and the fingering and the bowing, then I'm going to get a lot better. So something like this that happens at the level of the body, I know this is a bit of a random thought, but it just popped into my mind.
Yeah, it's relevant.
It does take repetition and patience.
Yeah. Because following that thread for a minute, you know, there are three main ways to change your patterns, habits, behaviors, right? One would be to make small repetitive changes over time. Two would be change your environment. Like where you're far away from some of the triggers, potholes, things like that, or where they're just not as available. And three would be, you know, say a mystical experience.
I was going to say 5 dried grams in silent darkness.
Yeah. And all of these are at risk for going back to where they were.
Right.
Like you could have a mystical experience, change for 5 days, and then start, you know, pick up that cigarette again, or start the same pattern. And you can do that after you've made small repetitive steps and reshaped your patterns, whether there's a latent pattern that's still getting extinguished or you're just starting back down that road again. And same goes for the change of environment. You might find the pattern again or come back to your old environment and let yourself revisit it.
Yeah. In case it wasn't obvious, as you're going through an embodiment practice or a healing process that involves embodiment, an important component of that is compassion, you know, empathy and self-compassion. I just, as I hear you talk about these different ways to change, and that a lot of times it involves a little bit of so-called backsliding.
Yeah.
It can't hurt and is probably really necessary to have some self-compassion along the way.
Be gentle with yourself. And so one other area of embodiment I wanted to venture into for a second would be the fact that some benefits of embodiment, the fact that deep satisfaction, meaningful connection, those things are only possible when you're embodied. And like that dial of you were talking about, get turned up in their potential the more and more you're embodied. You know, because when you're embodied, you have all these sense organs on board. Mm-hmm. You have the ability to feel things fully, mm-hmm. and the resources to rebound from, you know, the insults you might get along the way too.
That's an important point. You know, if you've lived life disembodied and you're finding your way back to your body, you're finding your way to a portal through which you will experience intense pleasure. Like,
pain,
but it's all exquisite, right? Pain can be exquisite and pleasure can be exquisite. But it's the path away from numbness. It's a lot of reasons why people who have, let's say, you know, we talked a lot about antidepressants last time in our depression episode, people who have taken antidepressants and maybe their depression, their mood has flattened out a bit, which feels better than it being very, very depressed, but they often go off of their antidepressants because they feel numb. They feel totally disembodied or disconnected. And some people they'll take their sad moods, even if it's a package deal, because they want to have the highs back and they want to have like that intimate connection with sensation and experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting about pain too, what you said about it. And maybe that helps explain why people do seek out discomfort and gain from it in certain ways, and why there's a distinct difference in like this surprise, traumatic, inflicted pain. Mm. You know, of course, the more resources you've worked through, the more they'll help in those situations, but we're never prepared fully for traumas, like right. the big ones. But on the flip side, I am trying to kind of embody this mantra we've talked about on here of seeking discomfort. And while it's not quote unquote cool anymore to talk about, because people talked about it too much, things like heat and cold exposure, like I'm feeling embodied right now, so I'm just going to say it, even though it may not be cool, but I have this habit lately of every morning when I wake up, I'll just flip on the sauna, sit in there, and then get in the cold tub that is ready to go. And so this morning I'm sitting in there breathing, and after like 10 breaths, it started to hurt. I could feel it in my, you know, on my skin, how cold it was. So I got out, but I had the ability to get out. And that's right. like it's different when you're practicing it. Helpful, but different.
Yeah. And that's one of the criticisms I've heard, of people like us who talk about seeking discomfort is that it's a privilege.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people live in discomfort. They live in pain. They live in trauma. They live in terror. You know, it's not hard to think of groups of people who live that way. I guess to respond to such criticisms, I would say yes. And, if we are living in a way where we feel pretty disconnected, either because we're sedentary or because we're frozen to our screens, or we're just sort of chasing the next dopamine high one after the other, then, these things still do work. Like it is still helpful to go seek a certain kind of discomfort that like the ones you're describing, because on the other side, you find more
seek to life. Boredom.
Right.
Because maybe it takes sitting in the most painful boredom, like sitting in a silent meditation retreat, for example, to break through into these places you've never experienced before, for example. It does come back to me in terms of the benefits of embodiment, of getting to that place where you're not only inhabiting your body, but start to sense into the the aliveness and the senses of other people, like that attunement that we talk about on here of, you know, when you're embodied and walking through life, you know, you're going to soak it in more. You're going to feel the breeze on your skin and appreciate the, you know, the leaves and the birds and whatever, compared to if you're just walking down the street hunched over, and you've transcended space time with your mind, texting people in three different locations and just not feeling a damn thing in the here and now, other than just enough to not, run into a car.
You know, that makes me think of this movie. I love this movie, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty.
Oh yeah. Me
with
too.
Ben Stiller. And so there's this scene where, you know, he's trying to find this photographer, this wildlife photographer, and he finally gets to him and it's up in some frozen mountain peak. And he's out there trying to take a picture of this snow leopard or something.
I love
like
that part.
And then he decides not to take the picture. You know, he had been camping out forever, and he says something to the effect of, like, some of these I like to just keep for myself. And so I've had that thought sometimes as I'm on a hike or I'm out skiing and I'm tempted to take a picture of a beautiful vista or, you know, some really beautiful sunset. And I'll just say, no, I'm just going to instead be present. Cause what are the odds I'm actually going to look at this picture again, or I'll show it to somebody and they'll be like, oh, cool. So instead, I'm just going to try to drop in and be right here, right now, and soak it in.
I think I probably have Walter Mitty to credit for it, but at least 100 times have found myself with the phone or the camera pointed at something, and just something in me just says, nope, you can't capture it. You can't capture it that way. And I just set it down, even though I had done a little bit of depresencing to try and take the picture and multitasking, but it's kind of just a gentle way of reminding myself to just be.
Be here now.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Reed, thank you for this enlightening conversation about embodiment.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.